Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the US withdrawing its diplomatic personnel from Yemen as it urges its citizens there to leave for fear of an impending attack from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Charles Schmitz, the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies, joins us to discuss the narrow focus the US has on Al-Qaeda when Yemen's greatest security threats come from its own political and economic instability. Then we'll look into the remarks that the new president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, made at his first press conference, where he called for serious and substantive negotiations to end the standoff with the P5+1 over Iran's nuclear program. Nada Hashimi, who is the director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, joins us to discuss the new face on the same regime beset by rampant inflation, shrinking foreign reserves, and an expensive proxy war in Syria. Then finally, we will speak with William Gould, who arbitrated the 1992-1993 salary disputes between the Major League Baseball Players Association and the Major League Baseball owners. The author of Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil, will discuss Alex Rodriguez's forthcoming appeal of his record suspension and possible lawsuits to come, as well as the apparent availability of illegal steroids and growth hormones that are readily accessible in the Dominican Republic, where most of the 13 suspended players come from. Joining us now is Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is an associate professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States, and he has just returned from Yemen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Schmitz.
Thank you, Ian.
And on top of the closing of 20 U.S. embassies and consulates, you now have the warning from both the U.S. and the U.K. government to withdraw diplomatic staff from Yemen and urging their nationals, their citizens, to leave because of concerns of an Al-Qaeda attack that appears to be based upon an intercept of communications between the head of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and Nasser al-Wuhashi, the head of Yemen-based Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I guess my first question, Charles, is given all of this furor over both Edward Snowden's leaks and Bradley Manning, who's on trial, here you have an obvious leak from the administration itself saying that they've intercepted the head of Al-Qaeda's phone call. So doesn't that give Zawahiri an advantage to know at least that his phone calls are being intercepted?
Yeah, I don't know that it was a phone call. They just said electronic communication. I do have a question as to how they would get this, and if they had got this information, why they're not, why they can't get these guys. I know that Al-Qaeda, number two in Yemen, was killed just a few weeks ago when he got on a phone to make a call to Saudi Arabia. Al-Qaeda knows very well in Yemen that they have drones circling overhead and that they can't make mistakes like calling on cell phones and whatnot. So it's a little bit strange. But even if that's true, I mean, there is additional information, apparently, that I've been reading about that says that the Yemenis claim that they know that there's a number of Al-Qaeda-affiliated people that have come from outside the country and are gathering in Sana'a. Again, if they know this information, why they're not getting them is a question. But that would seem to lend credence to the information that we're getting, that something is up in Yemen. And not only did the U.S. close its embassy, but it also had Air Force planes land in Sana'a early this morning to evacuate staff, non-essential staff, and also American nationals that wanted to leave, which is an extraordinary step. I mean, usually in Yemen, the Yemeni embassy has been closed quite often, actually, in the last 5 years or so since a large attack on the embassy in 2008 in Yemen. And usually they just fly out on commercial airlines, but this time they flew in special forces, so they clearly are very concerned about something happening in Yemen.
So I get very conflicting pictures of Yemen from people that have been there and travel there a lot and study the country, and the general perception both from the press and from the government that this place is a haven for al-Qaeda and an unstable country where Americans now are not safe and have to get the hell out. I mean, so what?
Well, you know, it is. It's true. There's a lot of fantasy and projection that goes on in Yemen. And Yemen, I would say this, that I noticed in the announcements from the State Department and from the British Foreign Office that the concern is not only over al-Qaeda's potential threat in Yemen, but also about the kidnappings. And the kidnappings are a very real threat. They're a threat that has been established already. Yemen, in the past, in the 90s, had a whole series of kidnappings that were done by tribal groups, which were rather harmless. I mean, you would be held by a tribe for a couple of weeks at most. You'd be treated as a guest of honor, and then you'd be released. And there were quite a few of these. And these were issues over, you know, a water project or getting some relatives released from prison or getting some government employment, some kind of support for the tribal area, something like this. But in the last year or so, the kidnappings took a nasty turn in that it appears that somebody, perhaps related to al-Qaeda, but, you know, just as well could be organized crime in Yemen or rogue elements of the security apparatus in Yemen, have been holding people for a long period of time, making threats, publishing pictures and videos of these people pleading for their lives, and then getting ransom, very high ransom, of up to $3 million is one of them. And so it's turned into a very nasty game. That's a very real threat. So there are threats to Americans in Yemen, but and Yemen is a place where al-Qaeda is active. But the number of al-Qaeda activists is very, very small, and Yemenis don't support al-Qaeda. Yemenis consider al-Qaeda to be a very small concern for them and a nuisance rather than a real threat. They have much larger threats facing them. In the form of a very unstable political situation and a very unstable economic situation. And the political instability has led to security concerns unrelated to al-Qaeda, concerns about groups that are blowing up the pipeline that provides most of the revenue for the Yemeni government, groups that are blowing up the electrical lines from the eastern desert, so the power is going out in the cities all the time, and attacks on security people inside of Yemen, that some of which are related to al-Qaeda, but many of which are related to the political instability. In the Arab Spring of 2011, Yemen was on the verge of a civil war where the military had split their loyalties between competing elites, and they had sort of squared off in the capital city to have a final battle. And the Gulf Agreement, brokered by Saudi Arabia and the United States and other Gulf states, kind of backed them down. Now they're negotiating. But the core issues haven't been resolved, and there are very big core issues, political issues in Yemen that haven't been resolved between the elites, between new elites now that have emerged. And they're all kind of waiting right now for the completion of a transition process. It's supposed to culminate in elections in 2014 to see sort of how these issues are going to be resolved and who's going to resolve Yemen, and who's going to rule Yemen in the future. And, you know, in this interim period, it's very unstable, and Yemenis are very worried about their future. And if you ask Yemenis, you know, what their concerns are, al-Qaeda is not on that list. On their list is the economy, is the security situation, you know, the one that's unrelated to al-Qaeda, the political instability, their political future. People are quite pessimistic and scared right now in Yemen. And Yemenis, in essence, the only gripe they have against the United States, really, that you hear, is the drone program. People really do not like the drones. The drones are, they see it on the one hand as a violation of their sovereignty, and another, it's very fearful. In the southern areas in particular, southern provinces of Yemen, where the drones are very active, in the eastern parts of Yemen, people fear what's going to come out of the sky. And in fact, today there was a report in the paper about the drones flying around Sana'a. They've been flying around Sana'a, and you know, people fear. People hide because there's these planes that are circling around, run by the American government, that may rain missiles down upon them at any moment. They don't know. So it's psychologically very disturbing. And Yemenis are just universally against these. And they, but this is they see as part of the U.S. government. They don't see this as something of the American people. And Yemenis are very, very friendly. When I was in Yemen just a few weeks ago, you know, people on the street would just invite me into their house, not knowing me at all, just seeing me as a foreigner. Well, they would invite me in the house, please, you know, come visit. Yemenis are extremely friendly, and they recognize that the American government is, and its policies is not the American people. And Yemenis admire the United States. They admire the United States for its freedoms, for its economic development, for its power. What they don't like is the way that the U.S. government is raining missiles down upon them in Yemen.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Schmitz, who's the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is an associate professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. And he's just returned from Yemen. Four suspected al-Qaeda members were killed by a drone strike in central Yemen, according to tribal leaders. And you mentioned that the one thing that the Yemeni people seem to agree on in terms of the United States is that they're opposed to the drone program. And it would seem that if the real problems are what you just related to us, which is political instability and these warring factions amongst the elites, you'd think that a little diplomatic muscle and a little bit of economic help would solve that problem. How can you worry about a country becoming a failed state and becoming a haven for al-Qaeda? Wouldn't the first priority be to bring about political stability? I just don't understand how the U.S. priorities seem to be on killing people with drones as opposed to knitting together this country, which is, you say, is predisposed to liking America.
Yes. The United States has played a key role in brokering the agreement that brought about the transition. And it was, in fact, the threat of a civil war that spurred the United States and Saudi Arabia to become very active in trying to negotiate some kind of a peace agreement among the elites. The issue is that the peace agreement among the elites isn't going to resolve the problems that Yemen face, or it's not assured to. The people on the street that were demanding fundamental change in Yemen, which may be necessary in order to bring about, political and economic change, they have been sort of marginalized, and the old elites that used to rule Yemen before the events of 2011, they're essentially back in power. There's only so much that the United States can do, quite frankly. The United States can't really change the Yemeni economy. It can help. And it does. I mean, it does give some economic aid and assistance and whatnot. Where the United States could really play a role is in applying some pressure on the neighboring Gulf states and Saudi Arabia to change some of their policies. For example, to allow more Yemeni workers into the Gulf. The Gulf is opposed to this because they don't really like the Yemenis. They see Yemenis as a security threat. But the reality is that Yemen is a security threat to them right now, and that allowing workers into those areas would substantially reduce unemployment and help the Yemeni economy. It's something that the Gulf opposed to, and the United States kind of lets the Gulf get away with this. The United States could play a much more helpful role in trying to broker something like that, rather than trying to give economic loans and stuff like this. The United States doesn't have a lot of money to throw around in that sense. The Saudis play a much larger economic role in Yemen than the United States does. So the United States could play a leadership role there. In terms of the political settlements, it's simply going to take time. I mean, these are big issues that Yemen is facing. They had a secession movement in the south. They've got another armed group in the north that basically has succeeded. It has political and military autonomy. It doesn't want to succeed, and it doesn't want to rule Yemen, but it wants to control its own area. These are serious challenges that the Yemeni, it's going to take time. It's going to take much longer than the next elections to work out. And so I think from the U.S. perspective, what needs to happen is a long-term thinking about economic and political stability in Yemen, more along the lines of a 10- or 20-year plan rather than the usual 2- or 3-year plan that we hear about.
So, Charles Schmitz, What are the security threats that the Yemeni government and military face then? Because the Yemeni military helicopter was shot down yesterday by militants, I believe in the same area where the Al-Qaeda, so-called Al-Qaeda people were killed by American drone missiles. That's the Marib.
It's the Eastern Desert.
Yeah.
Yes, Marib, the Eastern Desert. That's right.
And the general was killed along with the and he was the head of a unit that was protecting oil facilities in that neighborhood.
Right.
So you mentioned economic sabotage against the government. So how much is that going on, and who is responsible for trying to sabotage and weaken this government, not to mention killing its generals?
Yeah, the people that brought down the helicopter were not Al-Qaeda. They were there are groups, tribal groups, and other groups in the Eastern Desert, which is a very sparsely populated area, but it's the area from which the main oil for the north comes from, and it's also the area where the electrical generation plants all are. So all the electrical lines for the electrical grid come from that area. So in terms of the infrastructure, it's a very vulnerable area, and there have been constant attacks. Since 2011, there's been constant attacks on the electrical and on the oil installation, on the pipelines, and the government seems incapable of stopping them. And who's behind it? That's a very good question. In Yemen, it's often assumed that the former president, Ali Bellasar, who wants to play spoiler and show this government can't control and position himself or his family for a political comeback in the next set of elections, he's often accused of it because these people seem to be well-funded and very capable of eluding the military out there. And the Yemeni military can be very capable if they put their resources together. They were the ones that defeated the Al-Qaeda insurgency in the south in a matter of a month or so, very quickly. It's a big question as to how these people are able to continually attack, particularly the electrical lines all the time, and the power go out in the capital cities all the time. Why is it this is able to keep going? They seem to have powerful political backing.
And you think it might be the Salaf? Yeah.
This is in Yemen. This is in Yemen. It's assumed that the former president is behind this, or people were affiliated with the former president, because they clearly have some kind of backing.
Right. Well, he took the U.S. and the Saudis a lot of effort to get rid of that guy, right? He got blown up and went to Saudi Arabia for medical care, and he seemed to be extremely reluctant to leave powers. So
and he still plays a big role in Yemen. I mean, he is out of power, but his people and people who support him still have prominent positions in the government. And there are a lot of people in Yemen who also support him or people affiliated with him. So he and his people are still a very important political force inside of Yemen. And so what that shows you is that, Yemen's big security concerns and the sources of its instability are not related to Al-Qaeda in that sense.
So just given that following the sudden closure of 20 U.S. embassies and consulates on Sunday, you have the U.S. and U.K. governments withdrawing their diplomatic staff from Yemen and urging their citizens to leave the country. If you were still there, you're just back from a couple of weeks ago, if you were still there, would you leave?
I might think about it, or what I would probably do is simply restrict my movements, be very careful, which I did anyway because of the kidnapping, but I would be extra careful. I would stay away from major symbolic places like the embassy or, major government building or something like that, and I'd probably, lay low. I'm not sure that I would actually leave. I might just, lay low for a while before going.
Well, just in closing, though, it seems to me that what you're telling us, though, is that it could be the former president who's a greater security threat to the country than Al-Qaeda, and that his power, long protracted power struggle, which we thought had ended, may not have ended, and that the priority, as far as most Yemenis are concerned, is for their own country to get its act together, to bring about political stability, and then some economic stability will follow, and that here we are spending all our money shooting drones at people in the desert, and that seems to be our priority. So is there a disconnect there?
Yes, there is a bit of a disconnect. I just would add one thing, Ian, that it's not just the former president. The issue is that there are many competing blocs And none of them can dominate. So you have the former president, you have the main opposition part of the Islah party associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamic groups, you have the Houthis in the north who are completely separate, who are an armed group who control territory, and you have the Southerners in the south, in addition to other groups. So it's not just the former president, it's many different groups that are in political and military competition in Yemen. That's what lends to the instability. Yes, the United States has received a lot of criticism, repeated criticism, for a long time about its focus on terrorism. And within Yemen, they often criticize the United States for its, you know, overarching concern with security to the expense of other concerns. And, you know, the Yemenis kind of say, well, if you'd like us to cooperate, you know, in the concerns of Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda is not a real big concern for the ordinary Yemeni, then you need to show that, you know, you're interested in the ordinary Yemeni concerns. And you hear this over and over again. And the feeling is that the United States really is not. The priority of the United States is combating Al-Qaeda and security. And even if you go within the realm of security, what the Yemenis say there is, what the United States should focus on is enhancing Yemeni capacities rather than sort of overreaching and doing what the Yemenis could do. And there's a question about the approach of the United States, its exclusive use of kinetic force, versus, you know, many cases where, you know, the guys could have been captured and brought to trial. Why is it the United States prefers to kill people rather than, you know, bring people to trial and use due process? And this is particularly the case with al-Awlaki, Anwar al-Awlaki.
No.
You know, he was a U.S. citizen that was assassinated, and, you know, why wasn't, on the basis of him being an al-Qaeda ideologue, right, or some other basis. We don't know what the basis was, right? And so the Yemenis are suspicious about this. They would like to see rule of law established. This is what they need for their own country, but they would like to see the United States apply it to itself as well.
Well, Charles Mason, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're quite welcome, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations in the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States, and he just returned from Yemen. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the new Iranian leaders' press conference today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book out soon is The Syria Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thank you.
And the president, Hassan Rouhani, Iran's new president, has called for serious and substantive negotiations to end the standoff with the P5 plus one over Iran's nuclear program. Is he a new face on the same government? Is there anything here to hope that this long impasse will be broken?
Well, I think there is, room for some very cautious optimism, but I think it has less to do with the figure of Hassan Rouhani, who is an interesting person in and of his own capacity. But I think the reason why there is some cautious optimism is because it seems as if the senior Iranian leadership is hurting under these sanctions, that there is a sense in Iran among the senior leadership that the prognosis for the economy, for the country, is a disaster unless the sanctions can be lifted. And, of course, the sanctions can't be lifted and won't be lifted until there's some resolution of the nuclear question. So it seems that based on the press conference today, that Rouhani has been given a green light to try and engage in, as he said, serious and substantive talks with the United States to resolve this question.
So when Rouhani said that the United States had not responded in an appropriate and practical manner after June's presidential election, he was asked several times at the press conference, which is largely most of his questions came from foreign reporters and from a few local reporters. By the way, he did not take any questions from reporters from the conservative Iranian press, but he was asked several times about a possible thaw with the United States, and he was reminded of what the White House spokesman Jay Carney said, that the Iranian government would find a willing partner in the United States if it was willing to engage substantively and seriously to meet its international obligations and find a peaceful solution to this issue. But then Rouhani said the U.S.'s practical actions are more important to us, not their statements. And then he went on to talk about how the U.S. essentially was taking orders from a warmongering group opposed to talks, which was taking orders from a foreign country, obviously a reference to Israel.
Right. I think the reference there was to the new round of sanctions that have been passed by the Congress. I mean, obviously, there's a distinction that we make here in the United States between the White House and the Congress. But since his election, there has been a new round of sanctions that have been passed against Iran by the Congress. And, of course, that has upset the Iranian regime. And I think that's what he was referring to. So there's sort of two voices that I think the Iranian regime is hearing, one from the White House that seems more conciliatory and open to dialogue, but one from the Congress that seems to be very different. And I think that specifically was what he was referring to.
And, of course, these new round of sanctions that the Congress just passed would make it even more difficult for Iran to access foreign oil revenues, which is really how these sanctions are finally abiding, aren't they? They're smuggling their oil through Iraq, but they can't find ways to get paid easily.
Right. I mean, the whole thing is a big mess, and the regime knows it. I mean, the sort of reports that have been published and statements by the incoming government, and if you read between the lines, there's a general recognition that the Ahmadinejad administration has been much more has mastered the art of mismanagement more than anyone could ever imagine, and that the economic sort of prospects and prognosis is far worse than anyone sort of had predicted. So there's a general sense that if things continue as usual, unless there's some radical change, radical departure from Iran's current policies and vice versa from the policies of the international community toward Iran, that the short term and the long term look very bleak, and that something has to change. And I think that's really at the root of this desire to try and re-engage with the international community to find a way out of this problem.
Again, I'm speaking with Dante Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and his latest book out soon is The Syria Dilemma. Speaking of which, the president of Iran at his press conference today said about the ongoing civil war in Syria, that, quoting, "In Syria, we condemn terrorism, foreign intervention, and sending arms." Well, isn't that the pot calling the kettle black? I mean, what's going on there?
I mean, there was two things that sort of struck me in the press conference that were just gross exaggerations, and that two statements that cannot be morally, I think, defended. One was the Syria statement. Here, Iran is sort of backing to the hilt, you know, the Assad regime, sustaining it, supporting it, arming it, allowing its ally Hezbollah to come to the rescue of a dying regime, and then at the same time, in the same breath, Rouhani is claiming that there should not be external intervention. What he really meant to say was that there should not be external intervention in Syria, except for us. So it's just a laughable statement that no one, I think, Syria takes seriously. The other sort of laughable and really objectionable statement that he made in the press conference was when he referred to his own election, and he used the phrase that the as a result of the election that brought him to power, democracy has been consolidated in Iran, and there's a dynamic political sort of democracy that has now taken shape. I mean, that's a joke. His election was the unfreest and unfairest election in the history of the Islamic Republic. And so I think one can't take those statements very, very seriously. But you're absolutely right on the Syria question. I think the only people who buy into those statements are, you know, hardcore ideologues of either the Iranian regime or the Assad regime.
Well, there's a theory out there that that part of the U.S. strategy. One of the theories is that the U.S. strategy in Syria is similar to what Henry Kissinger remarked about the 8-year-long Iran-Iraq war, which was it's a pity both sides can't lose, and that there's a certain cynicism that that what's happening there are the al-Qaeda people are killing off the Alawite thugs that support this ruling family, the Assads, and a plague on both of their houses. Another theory that's also been floated recently is that Syria could become Iran's Vietnam. So is there anything to that possibility that both Israel and the United States are sort of happy to see Iran drawn deeper and deeper, and Hezbollah as well? Because my understanding is it's costing Iran considerable amount of money, not to mention materiel, and they're actually sending soldiers as well, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't think my own reading of U.S. foreign policy towards Syria is not as, I think, conspiratorial or sort of comprehensive along the lines that you sort of have outlined and that sometimes you hear in certain political constituencies
sure.
here in the United States on the left. I think the United States, if you listen to the statements, if you listen to the public record and you read sort of those statements closely, it's pretty clear that the major motivating factor on behalf of the Obama administration with respect to Syria policy is really the legacy of the quagmire in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's no war appetite in this country. There's no desire to get involved in another Middle Eastern war. If you recall, at the time of the Libya uprising, the United States really had to be dragged kicking and screaming into that event. It was really the Europeans who were pushing, and the Obama administration reluctantly at the end signed on to the project, and they were happy that Gaddafi fell, but they were getting very nervous 6 months after the bombing had started that there was no sign that the regime was going to capitulate. And so with respect to Syria, I think the parallel that I draw and the sort of the images that I have is really with the Balkans in the 1990s and the Clinton administration. You know, there was massive human rights violations. There was a sense that there was a lot of moral reasons to intervene, but Clinton back then, just like Obama right now, did not feel that vital U.S. Strategic interests were at stake, and so they were prepared to simply stand on the sidelines and try and put on a brave face. But really, they didn't want to get involved because they feared of getting dragged into another war that had no end in sight. So I think that's really the motive. It's really my reading of it. It's just a basic, narrow sort of realpolitik calculation on what's in it for the United States, and it's better to just, as long as the conflict can be contained within Syria's borders, a little bit of spill out in Lebanon and Turkey, but the hope is that it won't get any worse than it already is, that things can simply sort of continue and the United States need not sort of devote more time and energy on this question than they have to. So I think that's really my reading of it. I haven't seen any evidence that there's a Kissingerian sort of desire to sort of drag Iran into a Vietnam, although I'm certain that certain political constituencies in Washington would love to see that happen. But I don't think that's really the motive, the driving factor that explains U.S. policy towards Syria today.
Well, I think given, you know, my understanding of the government and how it operates in terms of foreign policy would indicate that it's much less likely to involve in to be capable of Machiavellian strategy as opposed to blundering into some sort of incompetence, which was, of course was the hallmark of Iraq. But it does seem that maybe if there's any strategy, it's basically to wait for both sides to exhaust themselves. But nevertheless, it is always a danger of this because it's a proxy war of the whole region igniting, isn't there? I mean, isn't that the subtext, the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran? And that seems to be not going away. And my understanding from talking to specialists, particularly on Iraq, is that Iraq is the weak link now, that Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you know, of course, the Bush administration tried to sell the war in part on the phony idea that there was an Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq. Well, now there is. I mean, and
That's one of the ironies, that there was no Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq, as everyone, I think, agrees. Prior to 2003, but as a result of the U.S. Intervention and occupation of Iraq, Al-Qaeda now has a very strong presence, and I think one of the most underreported and underdiscussed news stories that really tells you a lot about the legacy of U.S. foreign policy in many ways in Iraq is the fact that 1,000 people were killed in the month of July alone. I mean, every day we sort of see a report buried maybe on page 3 or 4 or sometimes further in the newspaper that another 50 people, another 60 people have been killed, largely by these Al-Qaeda-linked operations in Iraq. And, this seems to be continuing without any end in sight. And it's so routine now that we sort of become desensitized to it. But if anything, it seems like Al-Qaeda is much stronger now today than it ever was. And I think that really bodes ill for the future of the country, and it really raises serious questions about how long the country can hold together under this ferocious sort of attack of ongoing terrorist strikes against the civilian population.
And it's also against the Iranian-backed government of Maliki, who has clearly mishandled the situation. So you do have – I brought the Iraq issue up to fill out a broader picture of a kind of regional proxy war that is anything but under control. I mean, we talked earlier about how the Syrian situation, the U.S. is sort of mainly sort of feels that it's contained, but I'm suggesting that the whole situation is pretty tenuous, isn't it? And Iraq seems to be the weak link.
Oh, I agree. No, I agree. I mean, just looking at where things stand today, I mean, in the short term and in the long term, it seems like if anyone is going to be the victor here, it's going to be these Al-Qaeda-linked elements who are growing in strength in Syria and seem to be sort of operating under new energy in Iraq. And it really does, raise serious questions about the future of the Maliki government, about the future stability of the country. How long can this country in Iraq hold together under such a withering sort of attack by a revitalized Al-Qaeda movement? And so the entire region, not just Iraq, but also Syria, seems to be headed in a very dark picture. And I don't think anyone really has a clear sense of where things are headed. I think there's a sense from the United States that they are, they've withdrawn from Iraq and left sort of a very negative legacy behind. But also in the case of Syria, there's no serious attempt to intervene. The United States has basically turned over policy to its allies in the Gulf, and they're sort of the main players who are, I think, intervening and shaping events in Syria as outside regional interveners. But of course, Iran is on the opposite side, and this process is simply spinning out of control. There's no sense of where this is going to end, and so I think the prognosis looking forward looks incredibly grim for the entire region.
Well, just in closing, back to the domestic Iranian situation, I mentioned that most of the questions came from the foreign press at today's press conference with Iran's new leader. But there were some questions from local reporters. He didn't take questions from the conservative Iranian press, but he did got a broad range of questions about poverty and inflation and the economy and regional stability and corruption. And my understanding is, you know, his recent remarks on Quds Day, the day that the official holiday where the Iranian regime celebrates Quds, Jerusalem, the anti-Israel day, if you will, the remarks that he made there were various interpretations. I'm not sure what he did say. He certainly got a rebuke from Netanyahu in Israel. But did he once again call for Israel's destruction like Ahmadinejad routinely did?
No, I mean, that's what Benjamin Netanyahu wants us to believe. And in fact, when Netanyahu in his office was challenged over their claims that this is another Ahmadinejad sort of moment here, Netanyahu's office had to sort of admit that they had a wrong translation. What, in fact, he did say, and I think the language and the metaphor that Rouhani used was actually one that is opening a new chapter in Iran's relationship toward the outside world and a new attitude, at least rhetorically, from the Iranian regime toward Israel. And he used the metaphor of an old wound, that the question of Palestine and the creation of Israel, which is viewed by many people in the region as a colonial settler state that was built on the ruins of a Palestinian society, he used that phrase, used the metaphor of an old wound. And, you know, I think the wound is something that needs to heal. It sort of suggests that, you know, these calls, these incendiary calls about wiping Israel on the map, that's part of Iran's foreign policy past, not its future. So I think if you look at his statements on Jerusalem Day, they are, I think, they're much better suited. I mean, they're not ideal by any stretch of the imagination. But I think he did, as the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, capture, I think, a broad view and sentiment within the Islamic world toward the question of Palestine and toward the question of Israel. And this is, I think, something that many American listeners are not used to hearing, because there's a sense that we view Israel from our own sort of history of sort of anti-Semitism, the need to find justice for historic anti-Semitism and persecution of world Jewry. But, you know, from the Islamic world's point of view, they view the Israel-Palestine conflict through the prism of the dispossession and the ongoing subjugation of the Palestinian people. And that's what Rouhani was, I think, trying to articulate. And I think those words are ones that I think, you know, they do stand up to scrutiny. I think Iran has a right to sort of speak its mind on how it views the Israel-Palestine conflict. Of course, the actions and the attitudes of previous leaders calling for Israel's destruction, I think, needs to be opposed and challenged, because those are clear violations of international law. But I think Rouhani's statements on this question, I think, suggest that this new government that is in power now is going to be very different from the Ahmadinejad government. It's the atmospherics, the attitude, the people coming into the key ministries are going to be much more professional, much more sophisticated, and I think there's going to be new opportunities here to engage with Iran. Let's hope that everyone can bring their best face forward, and that these outstanding issues can be resolved, because if they are resolved, then everyone, I think, in the Middle East and in the world will really benefit.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Nader Hashemi.
Happy to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and he's the author of a new book out soon, The Syria Dilemma. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with William Gould, who negotiated the 1992-1993 salary disputes between Major League Baseball Player Association and the Major League Baseball owners, and is the author of Bargaining with Baseball: Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil.
Any day, the wind is a shame.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Gould, a Stanford Law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. He's arbitrated more than 200 labor disputes, including the 1992-1993 salary disputes between the Major League Baseball Players Association and the Major League Baseball Players Relations Committee. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Gould.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And your book, Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil, which is a great term, by the way, you have an entire chapter on the law and arbitration of drug disputes. But in terms of prosperous turmoil, just the A-Rod, the player who's had this record suspension, he may end up the Yankees may end up being relieved of paying him $34.1 million of the approximately $100 million remaining on his contract, but the money that he's made so far is extraordinary. In his 10-year contract, he got $275 million in 2007. And another $252 million in 2000. So these numbers are pretty extraordinary, aren't they?
They are. In his time, Rodriguez had the richest contract ever negotiated. I think that there are a few since then that are roughly comparable, a bit in excess of it, but. He got an awful lot for a long period of time. He, of course, was and might still be, although I rather doubt it, one of baseball's most outstanding players.
He's also apparently, according to Sports Illustrated, one of the least likable players in baseball, and he got booed. Was it yesterday that he played, or is it today? I'm not sure.
Last night.
Last night,
booed,
right.
With great enthusiasm by the Chicago crowd, and I dare say he'll be booed wherever he goes except for Yankee Stadium itself, where despite some dissent, I think probably the Yankee fans continue to love him.
So what is the is going on here vis-a-vis the Dominican Republic, where you have, I think, the majority of these 13 who have been suspended, I think 8 of them are from the Dominican Republic, where apparently steroids and human growth hormones are readily available, just over the counter, apparently.
Yes. Over the past few decades, baseball has recruited more players from the Dominican Republic as the cost of free agents and the bonuses associated with outstanding college and high school players have escalated. You're recruiting players from the most extreme depths of desperate poverty. Baseball itself has documented over the past 4 years or so in reports issued under the commissioner from the commissioner's office, how the prevalence of drugs, performance-enhancing drugs taken by players there, because players are anxious to do whatever they can to lift themselves out of the most desperate poverty and to have a chance to obtain some of these very handsome individual contracts which players have negotiated in recent years.
So do you have a kind of difference in culture, if you will, between the players from the Caribbean who have been recruited and, as you say, you know, come out of real poverty, and then you have all these college players here in the United States? Are there any politics behind the drugs and those who are calling for the banning of these drugs? Because
I think that a wide variety of players have used them. It's just clear, particularly in this last round of suspensions instituted most recently, arising out of the Biogenesis anti-aging clinic crisis down there in Florida, the overwhelming percentage are players who come from Latin America. But there are players inside the United States who have used performance-enhancing drugs. Mark McGuire, who broke home run records, has confessed, as has A-Rod himself, to taking performance-enhancing drugs. And so the use of them is widespread. And, of course, one of the disturbing things about these recent events is that although baseball has negotiated this past decade testing procedures for them, it seems quite clear that these testing procedures are inadequate, that the players, the cheaters amongst the players, are just a step ahead of the testers because most of these players were never detected as having violated the rules through the tests themselves.
Again, I'm speaking with William Gould, a Stanford Law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law, who previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board. He has arbitrated more than 200 labor disputes, including the 1992-1993 salary dispute between the Major League Baseball Players Association and the Major League Baseball Player Relations Committee. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. Now, when you mentioned Biogenesis, the company down in Florida, that's involved with Alex Rodriguez and some of the other players who've been suspended. You also mentioned Mark McGuire. He was associated with a Bay Area company called Balco, right? And they were doing the same thing. So what's the relationship between these shadowy companies that seem to be involved in dubious drug products and these big, rich baseball players?
Well, I think it's supply and demand. The players have recognized, and the owners, of course, are complicit in this, that home runs and great power and performance produce attendance, produce television contracts, produce transmission of baseball games through computers, and there's a lot of money to be obtained as the result of that. The players have been able to obtain part of it. We had, this really came to our attention because of the contest between McGuire and Sammy Sosa in 1998. They were involved in a very close struggle for the home run lead to break Babe Ruth's, to break Roger Maris's record, who had broken Babe Ruth's home run record. And both of them were subsequently discovered to have utilized performance-enhancing drugs. Along comes Barry Bonds, who says, "I'm really a much better player than either of these guys, and they're only able to have better statistics because of these drugs which are available." And a book was published called Game of Shadows by two San Francisco Chronicle reporters, which really kind of exposed Bonds' involvement in drugs. Congress holds hearings, and as a result of that, you begin to get what appeared to be, at the time, effective or testing procedures and greater sanctions for penalties for violating these testing rules. The extent of the appropriate sanctions is going to be, I think, at the heart of any arbitration which arises out of the A-Rod case, the Alex Rodriguez case, as this matter will go to arbitration. That is why he is able to play probably the entire most of the 2013 season.
Because the arbitration is expected to go on for a long time, right? If you look at what happened in 1992 with Steve Howe, they can also appeal these suspensions. So what does it say about the young kids? You know, parents, fathers take their kids to the ball games. These players are big role models. There's all this piety about cleaning up baseball and getting rid of drugs, but this keeps happening time and time again. It does.
At the time of the McGuire incident, the commissioner said the steroid era is over. Well, that's two or three years ago. And it just comes back to haunt us time and time again. And the most pernicious consequence of this is the message that it sends to young people, that this is the way to succeed. This is the way to perform in the game and to get attention. And we haven't heard the end of the A-Rod story by any means, and it may well be that he is successful or partially successful in at least reducing the suspension that has been imposed upon him. Steve Howe, whom you mentioned, was a left-handed, outstanding left-handed pitcher at the time of the use of recreational drugs, which was really baseball's problem in the 80s and 90s. And he was suspended seven times. And the eighth time, the commissioner wanted to ban him for life, and the arbitrator reversed that. Arbitrators have reversed penalties in many of these cases. Probably the commissioner's authority will be found in Article 12 of the collective bargaining agreement, which allows him to sanction players who materially damage the best interests of baseball. The case involving John Rocker of the Atlanta Braves, whom I discuss in my book, it also reversed the penalty that was imposed upon him for racist comments that he made in Sports Illustrated. But the arbitrator recognized in the Rocker case that the commissioner has the authority to take action against players who act against the best interest of baseball and materially damage the business.
Well, William Gould, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with William Gould, a Stanford Law professor specializing in labor and discrimination law. He previously served as chairman of the National Labor Relations Board, and he arbitrated more than 200 labor disputes, including the 1992-93 salary dispute between Major League Baseball Players Association and the Major League Baseball owners. His most recent book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.